You're going to hear today a conversation with Valerie Plame and Sarah Lovett, co-authors of the new novel, Burned. This is the second book in the series by author Sarah Lovett and former CIA officer Valerie Plame. We got together recently at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I am very glad to welcome you all here tonight. I'm delighted to be here again, what is it, 1 year later, with Valerie Plame and Sarah Lovett, talking about the new Vanessa Pearson novel, Burned. Welcome.
First of all, I want to say thanks you for everyone for coming. We're delighted to be here. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. You are just such a gift to Santa Fe. We're really lucky to have you. Thank you to Dorothy. I love Collected Works. Everyone is here because you love it as well. Aren't we lucky to have this place?
Yes, indeed.
Independent bookstores are really the heart of the community in so many ways, and we're lucky to have a thriving, robust one in Collected Works.
I wanted to ask you both, what was it like to write a novel together the second time around? How has the process changed? How has it gotten easier, harder?
Let's see. For me, I would say my learning curve is still pretty steep on writing fiction. So the second one, I'm still incorporating a lot of things that I've learned. Sarah and I very much wanted to do something that enriched the characters, made them more complex, of course, moved the plot along. And that's how we, you know, how can we improve upon what we did the first time?
What would you add? I agree with that, and you know, trying to deepen and reveal new sides, new facets. Also, this was not easier for a technical reason of it's a much larger cast of characters. She's traveling the globe, Vanessa, to all the exciting places, but there are a lot of characters to orchestrate. There's a lot going on, and. Mm-hmm. So there was a complexity to the ensemble that in Blowback it's more of a kind of lone wolf flow, you know, but yeah.
And we were obviously out of our mind when we agreed to do two books within a year's time frame. Well, sure, of course. What a great idea. And you know, this and it life gets in the way, and it was not easy to get this in and get all the work done that we wanted to on time.
I will say that's a very polite way of Valerie saying, I am not as good on deadlines as she is. Her line of work, you mess up, you don't get out of the airplane, you don't show up the next day. But in writing, it's more kind of, another week,
creative.
Another two. Yeah, that's a tricky thing, but that's very polite. Thank you.
I wondered how you, at the beginning and at this stage and going on to think about the next book, how you were conceiving of the narrative arc. Because each book has its own arc, but at the end of this book, we're definitely left waiting to see what happens next. Are you conceiving of this as a series with a certain number of books, or do you have any sense of what's going to happen? Are you kind of letting it unfold?
Well, the plot, everyone in this room, I think, will appreciate this. The plot of this book was pretty much laid out over a 3 to 4 hour hike up Atalaya Mountain.
That's right.
Which, as you know, it looks so gentle, but it's actually quite steep. And at the end, we could hardly talk. But, okay, well, what if you have him go and do this at the airport? So we had marked that out. That was sometime last summer. And I'll let you answer what's coming up, but that's how we worked. We got the basic act 1, 2, and 3 up and down Atalaya Mountain.
And we got a little exercise. That's always good, too, you can feel. Well, there is the issue of always in a continuing series, I think, when characters sort of walk off stage and when others walk on. And so one of the things that I think we are sensing through on, you know, with the follow-up to the cliffhanger sense of burned, is some resolution with Boot.
Mm-hmm. The evil villain.
The complex, multifaceted evil villain, yeah. So, but I think that's a tricky one because there's a question of how long do you continue a relationship, how long is it interesting, and especially in a sort of cat and mouse, and when is it time for somebody to just, you know, so that's part of it.
But I mean, so looking for, this was this book, but then what about, do you know how many books are in this series?
Hopefully it's really, really long.
So you'll basically
we'll be doing
do
this every October, Mary Charlotte.
We're trying to beat Sue Grafton on the alphabet, yeah. Right?
Yeah, we didn't mean to make it alliterative with blowback and then burned, but that's how it turned out. So we if anyone has a good
right.
title for with a B for the third book, please let us know.
Barfing in Turkish prison.
I was thinking of Betrayed.
Ah, better.
Well, I have one thing to talk. I was talking today on Collected Words, the radio, and the question came up of how Vanessa has changed. And I think very much in this, I mean, although she is a character, you know, she's someone who really thinks she can handle almost anything on one part of her. She can handle anything that comes at her. And another part of her, she is very inexperienced and, you know, getting experience quickly, and she's rash, which is a good thing for someone in an action thriller, you know, to be that. But that is part of who she is. But I also think that there's a maturing that happens between these, just in these two books, where with the sense of without giving things away, when you realize what can happen to you, the potential of how you can be left out in the cold, so to speak. So, you know, there's been quite an arc from one to two for her.
And I would just add that in real life, for someone to become an experienced CIA officer is at a minimum 5 years of where you actually become effective, because you're brought in, you go through intensive training, paramilitary, then operational training. Say you have language, there might be training in surveillance detection and so forth. And then, boom, you're put out into your first field assignment, say 3 years actually after you've been hired by the CIA. That's if all goes well. Assignments generally go in 2 to 3 year cycles. So the first one, you are just as green as the day is long. You've had all this academic notions of how a recruitment is supposed to go, how intelligence collection is supposed to unfold, and then there's real life. Reconciling those two and navigating those waters takes some years.
So another 5 years after your training has ended?
Yeah, I think it's not until your second or third tour that you really begin to pull together the threads in your experience. I think that's probably true in many professions, to pulling that all together. The stakes might be higher in some cases, but the irony is, as you get older and you have that experience to bring to it, it's so much harder because you've gotten married, you have children, and this really is a young person's game because you're out 7 nights a week, sort of on a 24/7 schedule. It is intense, but you know. So what you lack in experience, you make up for in youth and useful energy, and then vice versa.
It's not a healthy lifestyle, and I wondered, I mean, you personally, having gone through this, and we can talk about sort of fiction versus real life in this book and in your books, but did you have any idea what you were signing up for when you entered the CIA?
No. But it seemed, I was a child spy. I can't say exactly when I started. The CIA has made it clear that I'm not permitted to acknowledge publicly that I had any CIA affiliation before 2002. However, what I can say is that I joined out of a sense of public service. I thought it seemed like it was a lot more interesting than what a lot of my friends were doing. I got to live and work overseas. And you're right, it is not a healthy lifestyle because of the pressures of it. I don't know what the figures are, but just anecdotally, I can tell you the divorce rate is astronomical. Alcoholism is probably prevalent. And yet you're supposed to carry on through all that. And you see some, like, you see some people that, of course, succeed and do well and manage in spite of all that. And you see others that really break finally under the accumulation of the pressures that come with a job.
Well, those pressures are intense because the work is so very scary. Not only are you in life and death situations, but you're in the danger of putting others in those life and death situations as well.
I would just say for me personally, it was the sense of responsibility. People are, in some cases, literally putting their lives in your hands. They're trusting you to keep their identity secret. They are trusting that you will protect them and their family. If it's a really sensitive case, they trust that the U.S. government is going to get them out of whatever country they're in, the asset as well as their family, and bring them to safety. That's you'd be surprised how rarely that actually happens, how skimpy the State Department is on those visas to bring green cards, to bring people in. You wouldn't believe what you have to do to in debt to the U.S. intelligence service to be granted a green card. But I felt that deeply, that sense of responsibility, even if I didn't particularly like the asset. It's not that's not what it's about. I am supposed to protect them.
What's in it for the asset? How do you get them to put themselves in such very serious danger?
Motivation is as varied as the individual, of course, you can imagine. The easiest and most obvious ones are money, financial gain. There is an ideological motivation. But there's also everything in between. I've had assets that cooperated with me and U.S. intelligence because they wanted our help to, say, get their son into school, college in the United States. Or they wanted a certain medicine for their very sick mother that they could not obtain otherwise. And that was enough. Sometimes it's revenge. Sometimes it's no one has ever really paid any attention to them. And all of a sudden they're flattered because you're asking them questions and you're paying them attention. So that is the trick, right? It's finding out what makes someone, what motivates them, what makes them want to be persuaded that they can break the law and commit espionage.
Let's talk about the demands of fiction on the one hand and the demands of realism on the other, and how those go together. Are they in tension? Are they in conflict? I mean, we have Valerie Plame, Vanessa Pearson. When I read about her, I think she looks exactly like you, or she is you, but she's not you. I mean, how do you, are you walking a line between, you know, on the one hand, real life situations and personalities, on the other hand, fiction?
I think so. For me, I mean, that's what I'm trying to communicate and work with. And I think you're always, you know, you've always stayed very clear of anything that was factual that would be endangering to anyone else, and, you know, but communicating the gist. But certainly the demands of the genre and the demands of, you know, from thrillers, commercial thrillers, and the potential for film, you want that. I mean, we did start out, we talked about this before, I think, but we started out with no weapons, right? And and it is a changing intelligence service. So there's a lot more militarization, I think, in what happens now anyway. So setting it at the time, Vanessa's 29. But I know that Valerie was not running around with a weapon most of the time, especially aimed at people. So, and that was a quick, you know, suddenly, oh, well, she needs to be in action. She needs to be able to defend herself. She needs a weapon. So, I mean, there are those kinds of leaps that happen. And sometimes you can, sometimes they fit in amazingly with reality and just the changes of time. Or for me, being outside intelligence, I'll hear a story that mirrors, oh, okay, that works for us. Mm-hmm. So, and other times you feel like, yeah, I'm pushing the envelope of what's real and what's fiction. But this is fiction, so, yeah.
We were writing this, of course, starting last summer and through the fall, and there's, I can't say that we're particularly prescient, except you could see what was coming in terms of radical Islam. We didn't think of ISIS. No one ever talked about ISIS, really, until about 6 months ago. But there is a group in Bern called True Jihad that is extremely radical, that is a precursor. I would like to say that, you know, we had it all. We saw the writing on the wall, but that wouldn't be true. But there, sometimes it was really hard in both Blobeck and in Bern to keep ahead of the news would catch up with us in no time, what we were writing about, and because the thread through both of them, of course, is the danger of nuclear proliferation.
I've been watching a spy TV show called The Americans, which is about these KGB agents
right.
who are living in yeah. suburban Washington, D.C. and raising kids who don't know their parents are Russians and all that. It's amazing. Because it's set in the beginning of the Reagan era, and I was, you know, you watch the technology that they're using, and it looks really kludgy and clumsy to our eyes. But I'm wondering how has the technological side of this changed, even, you know, in the period where you were doing that work?
Mm-hmm. Tremendous, tremendous advances. When I first started, you can figure this out, I was working with Wang computers, okay? It was a black screen with the flashing green mm-hmm. dot. It was just this side of DOS, D-O-S. But believe it or not, the CIA through the 80s was cutting edge in its technological advances, what they were doing. And somehow they completely lost the thread. There was a big push, though, in the late 90s, and then, of course, from 9/11 on, when there's been a tremendous amount of money thrown at our intelligence and homeland under the rubric of homeland security. But we are, as we see, of course, with cyber attacks, reports of that every other week, it is really hard to keep ahead of a Russian teenager who's determined to move money around. So that is definitely a whole new frontier.
I was wondering, I mean, we're in an era where there are, what, 16 different intelligence agencies in the United States right now. Would you, if this horrible outing hadn't happened some years ago and your name was revealed and you had to leave your work, would you still be in it now?
Oh, absolutely. If none of this had happened, I think my family and I would be overseas right now. I would be working on these issues. I'd be making my government salary and deriving a great sense of satisfaction from that. I loved what I did. I was really proud to serve my country, but it didn't end up the way, it didn't happen, unfold the way that I thought it would. So we ended up here in Santa Fe, and we're extremely happy for that, but it wasn't planned, I can tell you that much.
What is your view of the effectiveness or lack thereof in these different intelligence services? Are they working well? Are they communicating well with each other?
Really? So what happened after 9/11, which was considered to be an enormous intelligence failure, and you can, in fact, say that, but there was the 9/11 Commission set up, and in my opinion, it was really a knee-jerk reaction. Oh, this is a terrible intelligence failure. What do we need to do? Well, because it's Washington, the answer was another layer of bureaucracy. And they created something called the Director of National Intelligence. That's headed by James Clapper right now. You may know him because he lied to Congress. But, okay, that's an aside. So there's between 16 and 17
intelligence agencies that are reporting to this Directorate of National Intelligence. My opinion is that it is so big. I think of it as the military-industrial intelligence complex now. We spend billions and billions of dollars. The exact budget is classified. But I have heard time after time senior U.S. officials say at the very highest levels of government, it is simply too much there, because it's like drinking from a fire hose, right? They get their threat terrorist matrix in the morning. They get their briefings. They get, you know, red stripes, which is the very, very secret stuff. It is too much. And by that, I mean, I'm not advocating, oh, well, just, you know, cut it in half. But when it is so much coming in, we're humans and we have little pea brains, really. And it's very, very hard to strategize or prioritize all this information coming in, because certainly since 9/11, everything has been a five alarmer, right? You know, it's really hard to say, where do we need to put our total attention and focus, or what should the proper order be?
Do you think it would work better if it were a much more streamlined, smaller number of agencies rather than such a huge bureaucracy?
Yes, but of course, bureaucracy is the self-licking ice cream cone, right? I mean, it exists because it exists for itself. And there's, in Washington, if those of you have lived and worked there, you do understand how these enormous turf battles erupt. The more money you have, the more people you have working for you, the more powerful you are. And you might just even get your own parking spot. And I don't mean to be totally glib about it, but that is how things are driven. What happens is, and I saw this because I had my own budgets to work with in the CIA on covert action, you're given a budget. If you do not spend all your money that year, then it's reduced the next year. So that is not the most efficient way of running operations and so forth. What I would dearly love to see is, very simply, this is a whole other conversation, but very simply, more aggressive, competent congressional oversight, streamlining, yes. The Pentagon every so often threatens to set up their own sort of rival CIA. Can you imagine? You know, and it would, the problem is there is no intelligence constituency as there are for other issues, whether it's Social Security or immigration or so forth. It really is inside baseball and the jargon that goes with it, of course. And as a consequence, it has just grown and grown and grown to what I believe to a place where it's not very effective. We're just not getting the bang for the buck, I guess, is what I want to say.
Well, and then it seems like it's been interesting to follow a little bit of ISIS and the idea that they have very effective intelligence, you know, just the picture. Whether it's, you know, more on the ground or, you know, how they're gathering that, but compared to our government, our bureaucracy and our intelligence monster, you know, that they are such capable foes. And
yeah, and it's extreme. Think of ISIS, how difficult it would be to gather human intelligence. Sure, billion-dollar satellites and all the NSA metadata collection, that's very important. That's a very important element to understanding this really barbaric foe of ISIS. But it doesn't give us a whole picture. For that, I'm biased, of course, because I come out of human intelligence, but you really need that person-to-person understanding, some sense that you've developed some relationship to understand motivations, why this has happened, and certainly someone who looks like me is not going to be infiltrating any ISIS cell anytime soon.
It's funny. Sometimes more funding is counterproductive. I had somebody once come to the radio station and do an interview and said that the quality of the interview in a radio station was in inverse proportion to the quality of the equipment at the radio station. So if your microphones were kind of duct tape on, as opposed to these, you know, glass and brass studios.
Yeah.
So let's talk again about about fiction and the fiction writing process, do you get to tell things because this is fiction that you would not be able to say that would be redacted or censored if it were nonfiction?
Well, when I joined the CIA, I signed a secrecy agreement. I promised not to reveal sources or methods or classified information, which I completely respect and follow that very closely. So what goes into this, I guess there is some self-censorship, but the fun part is I get to add in characters that I met along the way, both from inside the CIA and outside. You can't make this stuff up. Sarah has heard many, you know, oh, and let me tell you about this person. And so taking pieces from that. So, yes, I guess there's certainly more freedom in being able to fictionalize. And I sent this through, as I did, of course, Blowback, through the agency review process, and they had very minor adjustments, happily.
And they did, with Fair Game, they were telling you, why don't you write fiction, right?
Yeah, I know.
Make it easy
Alrighty
on yourself.
Then.
Let's talk about film. Is there a possibility that these books might be made into a film?
From your lips to God's ears. We hope. I mean, there people have been nibbling, so we'll see. I think film reaches people in a whole different way, a very visceral way. I think it would be a lot of fun. We'll let you know. We'll have it here. We'll have a premiere at the Lensic, should that come to pass.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, again, I've been watching more television series, like on Netflix, than film lately. And there's a lot of really great TV in which they can take characters and themes and expand them over one, two, three seasons. Yeah. And you can do far more than you can in a feature-length film.
Oh, I think there's a general consensus that TV is far superior these days to what as comic book character you might see in the movies. That's where the stories are. It used to be actors would turn up their noses at doing TV. It was like only if they were really down on their luck. Right. And now that's where the stories are from, of course, The Wire, Orange is the New Black, House of Cards. There's so many. That's where these great stories are told. It is rare to find those on screen.
And so many great female actors. But I think there probably is a section of rehab now that's for Netflix streaming, those people who are, you need to come out of your...
Breaking Bad.
Your stupor. Yes, it is very, very addictive. You were saying there were great female actors, and it's always important and interesting when you've got female characters in traditionally male fields like intelligence. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about gender dynamics inside of an agency like the one where you worked.
I think it's fair to say it's still a man's world. Even though the CIA is quick to tout right now, I think the head of the intelligence analyst part, the DI, is a woman, and I think the number two in the director of operations is a woman. But that alone does not make it's systemic, as it is whether you're working in a law practice or medical practice or anywhere else. There are still some things systemically that are real hurdles. I personally found it I didn't want to bang my head against the wall against things that were going to be so hard for me to do, to achieve operationally, to be successful. So I tried to go after the areas where I could be. My expertise was in nuclear proliferation or counterproliferation, actually. And so when I was there, I was doing things undercover where I was really in business. I was talking to people, trying to figure out how they were moving money, how they were procuring different widgets that they needed for their nuclear program. And so my gender didn't matter. I had money, and they were interested in selling to me or whatever it was I was trying to set up. So that is how I threaded that needle.
You've been on tour with this book, both of you, or just how's that working?
I have. I'll be in Long Beach next week, but I've been, Valerie's been leading the charge.
Happily, yes, I have been on tour, and my mother is here visiting, Diane Plame. Yay, Mom. Could not do it without her. It takes a village. It really does. I have 14-year-old twins, and just moving them from A to B and C and D all the time requires a lot. So thank you to my mother for being here to do that. So, yeah, I've been, let's see, I did New York, Philadelphia. I was at the Spy Museum in Washington. How fun was that? If you ever have a chance to go there, it really is a good museum. Austin, Miami, Portland, Seattle, and more to come.
And how are people responding? Have you had any interesting encounters or adventures?
There's always hot people out there. There's yes. No, for the most part, people really have enjoyed it. I mean, maybe they're just being nice to me, but it is a page turner. We've gotten great reviews, and they seem to like it and waiting for the next one.
Do you get conspiracy theorists at every reading?
There's usually one or two, yeah. Mm-hmm. It just comes with the territory.
We want to open it up to questions, so there is a wireless mic that this nice gentleman behind you here will pass you. So if there's any questions, raise your hand.
Hi. I like the books. I've read two of them. I haven't read the latest, but anyway, I just wanted to ask about jargon because you use jargon, and is that they at the CIA, they say, okay, that's fine? I mean, it's like learning a new language, kind of.
Didn't we put I think there is a glossary in this one,
yeah,
right?
At the very back, yeah.
There is. There is a glossary because we heard that a lot with the first one. I think like any profession, it's the priesthood, right? That vernacular keeps the outsiders out there. And so we tried to, we were aware of that, I thought, and tried to explain it.
And walk the line. Do you read espionage as a general, a lot of espionage?
And never before.
So I think that's part of, you know, I know in crime genres and procedurals, and there's for people who don't usually read that, there's like, you know, what is that? And then, but for readers who are avid and read that stuff, then, or our wonderful books, there's an expectation that that will be included for realism, you know. So hopefully, and the glossary will help.
In the book Blowback, I was wondering if this is a problem in real life. You got the sense of important decisions being made with very little sleep. And it reminded me of, like, you know, what goes wrong in surgery maybe sometimes.
Residency.
I don't know is this like life in Washington in general, or specific to the CIA, foreign policy, that kind of stuff?
Good point. Yeah, like residents in the hospital, in the system, in the medical system. We try. Well, in fact, I will share with you that during my operational training, which takes place at a place, it's called the Farm. It's somewhere outside of Washington, D.C. Very intense operational training where you learn things of how to spot, assess, develop, and recruit, how to write intelligence reports, how to take clandestine photography, identify surveillance, you know, the whole gambit of what's called tradecraft. So this went on for 4 months approximately. Well, you know, they had decades to perfect the pain that you would go through, and it became increasingly clear that what they were trying to do was see how well you've performed under decreasing amount of sleep. Because, I mean, there's a reason that sleep deprivation is used as a torture device, because it deeply disorients you, disturbs you, challenges your judgment, and so forth. And so they really, that was built into the whole training program of doing that on very little sleep, and how did you still pull it together? Was your judgment still appropriate? Because so much rests on that. And true enough, in the real job, a lot of it is does follow that, because you have your cover job, whatever that is, whether that is you're
a visa officer, consular officer in an embassy, and you tell people, oh, yes, I just stamp visas all day. It's really boring. When, in fact, as soon as the day ends, you go out and you start your meetings at night. You come back, say, to the embassy at midnight, or maybe you go home and get a few nights sleep, depending on how urgent the report is, and then you need to be in at 7 a.m., writing up your report to get it back to Washington and so forth. So there, you know, the whole sleep deprivation is very, very true. But I was just, that also just reminded me, I had a classmate of mine that I've kept in touch with. He's out of the agency now, but we went through the training together. He lives outside of New York. I think he works for somewhere on Wall Street now. But he's been friendly, and he reads all this stuff. And I have to show you, Sarah, because he's reading Blowback right now, and he says, I'm your pain in the ass proofreader. And he makes some note about how there's something a little bit off about the timing of when she gets on an airplane and when she gets off. Really, Michael, I want to say. But so that might have been done under, you know, less than ideal conditions.
The writing of the book itself. I read somewhere the other day that when Barack Obama became president, Bill Clinton said to him, the most important thing that I have to tell you is get sleep. Because the worst decisions that I made, he said, were when I was sleep deprived as president.
Well, we know, although it seems as a country we intellectually understand that, the truth is so much we continue to drive ourselves with caffeine and staying up too late and doing all the wrong things, as you see, and as I have two teenagers now. All the studies have shown that they do much better when school is pushed forward a little bit, mm-hmm. because the teenage brain, really, the way there's many things going on with that teenage brain, but one of the things is that they really want to stay up later and get up later. And the schools that have pushed their opening times in, you know, to 8:30 or 9 o'clock have shown remarkable increase in grades and attendance and just all around better behavior.
Some of us are still like that.
What are your thoughts about Edward Snowden?
So the question, if you didn't hear, was about Edward Snowden. So I like to start off by saying I don't, I will perhaps disappoint you by not immediately putting him into the traitor or the whistleblower camp, because I think that completely misses the point. It doesn't matter. He's really just a shiny ball that the media is chasing. He's very interesting in the girlfriend and the trip to Moscow and so forth. The real issue that we as Americans need to be discussing in a very robust manner is what is the appropriate balance between security and privacy in a healthy democracy. Now, we can argue about the healthy part of that democracy, but that is where it boils down to. And for those, it's been, as I have followed this very, very closely from the beginning, which was last June when we first found this out. And, you know, there's very strong opinions on all sides of this, which is very, it's worthwhile to debate, absolutely worthwhile. But I always come down to say, would you rather not know? Would you rather not know what the government is doing in our name, and that we have, in my view, have given up so much? I think there was, this country historically tends to swing one side wildly to the other. And I think after 9/11, I think there was what I would call an overreaction. I was just in Washington, D.C., as I mentioned. It is a boom town. Unbelievable. If anyone's been there recently, I go a couple times a year. I am never fail to be shocked at the money that is there. It's this unbelievable bubble of money, and it comes from Homeland Security, defense contractors. This has all been pumped into the system from 9/11. There's that terrific book by Dana Priest, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, called Top Secret America. She talks about the incredible growth of Top Secret America from 9/11 on. So with Snowden, that'll be interesting. I mean, the bottom line is we as the average citizens don't really know how much. We only
have his word for it, that he tried to tell his supervisors about his concerns of what the NSA was doing and so forth. And then on the other hand, we have, now he's retired, but Keith Alexander, who the head of the NSA, who said, he never raised his hand and had said he had any sort of anxieties about what the NSA was collecting. We don't really know. So that part, I think you just have to put aside and focus on what are the issues. What kind of country do we want to have? What kind of society? How much are we willing to give up? I always think of it in terms, for me, I don't want to live in a country where there is, maybe this sounds strange, but where there is absolutely no possibility of a terrorist attack. And I say that because otherwise it is North Korea, okay? I mean, there are no guarantees in life. And I am willing to live with that possibility. You have to. I don't want to live in such a tightly controlled society, a country, where supposedly it's, you know, of the people, for the people, by the people, where in fact all the power is concentrated, too much information about us in the hands of a few because the potential for abuse is too great. But other than that, I have very few opinions.
I have a question for both of you, but first I'd like to say that I'm now a card-carrying member of the Spy Museum Book Club.
Okay.
I was there 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
My question for both of you is, do you have, and I'm a big fan of the espionage fiction genre, do you have role models or favorite authors that you've really appreciate and have really, I guess, empowered you?
David Ignatius. I also read people like Rucka. You know, he's got a British, basically a woman who's an exterminator in MI6. So, but for different reasons, you know, for me, from the writing standpoint, reading different aspects of the genre and pacing and what they're doing, what they're going for. So, but I also read people like Kate Atkinson, who is not espionage. I just like British mystery, and, you know, I end up reading a lot of nonfiction to keep for research, you know, just especially on deadline. And, you know, the sleep deprivation, as a writer, I know we're up there with the doctors and the intelligence people when it's deadline hour. So it does sometimes bleed over into the pages. But so a lot, I'm reading, you know, Greenwald right now, the Snowden book, and those kinds of things.
For fiction, I like Graham Greene and Le Carré. I mean, top drawer, of course.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what it's like to write as a team, what the writing process is like.
Well, my answer to that one is I spend a lot of time in my fluffy slippers and my pajamas, and Valerie jumps out of airplanes. So, you know, sometimes it's hard to get, we're on Skype together. I think every collaboration is different. I really, you know, I mean, I know every collaboration is different. I've done some in theater, and I have friends who collaborate, and Hollywood has a whole way of 200 people writing the same thing, right? We do a lot of, as Valerie summed up so well on our hike up Atalaya, we do a lot of talking through as far as how things will unfold, how a scene will unfold. That's invaluable for me. It's invaluable for me to have, you know, and sometimes I feel odd saying it because it's not like I think of Valerie as a specimen under, you know, but for a fiction writer, it's great to see, how do you do that? So, but there's a lot of, you know, planning that way and then back and forth on how characters would react, how meetings will unfold, how agencies will interact. And then sometimes there's going away and I just, you know, use my fictional tracking system and go and then bounce. We bounce back and forth in Valerie with an editing process. So
I would just add, I don't mean to be cliche about it, but I think
at least for us, I've never collaborated before, but we each bring really different strengths to the table, and you focus on that, right? I mean, that's the best thing you can do, and hopefully, and in our case, it complements, it works.
And I guess the other thing too is the characters that some like. I mean, it's like having, and these are again fictionalized versions, but like you say, you know, there was this person. So it's really wonderful when, you know, sometimes characters like drop onto the page, you know, because they are living, breathing embodiments already. So that's very fun, you know.
Do you consult with other people besides Valerie who have the information that you're looking for?
Yes.
In the book?
Yes, we do. Well, and right, because also there places where neither of us have the information. So, like, expertise in firearms.
Right, we're completely shameless. We will call up people, you know, through a friend of a friend of a friend that give us sometimes you just need a nugget of something. But Paul Evenko in Blowback, especially when the first book, he's a former SEAL, and his weapons expertise, he was busy telling Sarah how big a gash a so-and-so caliber would cause in your knee. And because we wanted it to be accurate.
And he was pivotal. If you don't know the climactic scene in that one, he was so generous. He was like, well, wait, I have an idea. It's like, great, and you'll share. You know, really, people are so kind that way often, I think, with expertise.
And this is obviously a collaboration, but I think, and you can speak to this, so much fiction is also, even by one author, is still a collaboration because so many people contribute in one way or another.
Right. I think that's true. I guess, some people do work. I do hear of people who just, I sat down and it just all channeled through. But sometimes I think if you don't revise and reach out and talk to those experts, you kind of can tell it was channeled through. So we're not sure who it was channeled through. But, I think, and I also think now the world we live in, and there's so many areas of expertise. There are just so many that nobody can hold all that.
Little niches and what you cannot find amazing on YouTube and on the internets, amazing. You have the most esoteric question, and someone has thought about it, and it's there.
It's so true. Any other questions?
Hi. Oh, I hate these things. I have a follow-up for Sarah. You talked about, when they asked about favorite authors, actually for both of you. Once you've written something, is it then an occupational hazard when you read that you look for I don't want to say flaws, I don't mean that, but you read it differently than if you've never written, so I get really into the story. Do you find yourself stopping and going, oh, I would have done this differently, or wow, that's a good idea?
You're talking about when I'm reading other people's work, not my work.
No, other people.
Because that definitely is,
other people.
Ooh, ow, I could have done that better. Not if it... You know, I love to be like any reader. I want to be entertained and swept away. You know, and so I really do enjoy reading people who, play with words, and it's almost a music and takes. So there's a lot of rather than reading constantly in one genre that I then can become obsessed by. I will say, one sort of hazard of the trade is that it's rare when I see a movie or read a book that has to do with crime, and I don't figure it out before. I mean, that's a hard one. It's like, I know who it is, and it is. So anyway.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming tonight. The books are available at both counters. You can pick up a copy of the book, and Valerie and Sarah will be signing. Thank you so much for coming to this fabulous bookstore and supporting these wonderful authors.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks.
Thank you, Collected Works.
And that was Valerie Plame and Sarah Lovett talking about their new novel, Burned, the second in the series of Vanessa Pearson spy thrillers. Our conversation took place at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe.